Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters. A woman-owned coffee shop dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. Offering teas and signature drinks like the Hilltopper. Located on Pete Ellis Drive. Needmoreroasters.com. From WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana, I'm Kate Young, and this is Earth Eats.
There are four broad categories of real food: ecologically sound, local, humane, and fair.
This week, we take a look at what it takes for a large institutional food system to commit to offering real food. And Jackie B. Howard is back to unroll the cabbage roll and top it with Romesco sauce. That's all just ahead, so stay with us. First, some news with Alex Chambers. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Kate. Agribusiness mega-mergers and data consolidation are major roadblocks for global sustainable agriculture, says a group of sustainable food policy experts in the European Union. The International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems collaborated with more than 400 farmers, scientists, activists, and policymakers to write a common food policy platform for the EU. Released last week, the report outlines how the EU can build a more sustainable food system. The report claims agribusiness mergers lead to overconsolidation of farming data. That makes the data hard for the U.S. Department of Agriculture and Extension Services to access. Farmers have historically relied on those services for their information. The report points out that 70% of the global agrochemical industry is now in the hands of only three companies, and up to 90% of the global grain trade is controlled by four multinational corporations. These agribusinesses, like Bayer, DowDuPont, and BASF, use agricultural data to create their own ag tech platforms. For farmers, the potential benefits of these software programs are enormous. The programs can help analyze soil conditions and crop yields and how much water, fertilizer, pesticides, and herbicides crops need. They can even identify which plant varieties perform best in a given region. But Peter Karstensen of the University of Wisconsin Law School says that when information sources are tied to big companies, it gets even harder for farmers who want to do other things, like be sustainable. The Sustainable Food Systems panel proposes open-source data systems to make large agriculture data sets more accessible to all. Participation in school breakfast programs is up 1.2% in 2017-18 compared to the previous year, according to the Food Research and Action Center. About 12.5 million public school students each day eat breakfast at free or reduced rates. A major reason for the program's growth is an expansion of the Obama-era program called the Community Eligibility Provision. Under that program, schools or districts where at least 40% of the student body qualifies for free meals can offer those meals free to all students. The school is reimbursed between about 30 cents to $1.75 per meal, depending on the percentage of low-income students. The program reduces stigma by making breakfast for all students into a norm. It also brings federal dollars into schools in high-poverty areas. Several studies have shown strong links between school breakfast and academic performance, as well as student behavior in school and mental health, particularly for adolescents. And that's the news. Thanks to Taylor Killow and Chad Bouchard for those stories.
And thank you, Alex Chambers.
Happy to do it, Kate.
When it comes to green living, sustainable living, we talk a lot about individual choices. While it certainly feels good to buy directly from a local farmer or to support my local co-op, real change in our food system, it needs to happen at a larger scale than my personal household. The scale of a major state university might be a good place to start. Indiana University here in Bloomington, Indiana, is engaging in the Real Food Challenge. I attended an event on campus in the fall to learn more about it.
We're here at Big Red Eats Green, and your name is?
I'm Stephen Lalovich. I'm a registered dietitian for Healthy IU and also one of the co-chairs of the Food Working Group who is putting on this event through Sustain IU. So the Real Food Challenge is a national organization that's driven by students to shift the university food system toward a more sustainable food system. And there are four broad categories of real food: ecologically sound, local, humane, and fair. So if food meets certain criteria within each category or within one of those categories, then it qualifies as real.
I'm Carl Ipsen. I'm a professor of history and I'm the director of the IU Food Institute. When I was the faculty co-chair of the Food Working Group of the IU Office of Sustainability, about 6 years ago is when we started doing this. Angela Babb was the intern. She was really the driving force. And we started to get students interested, and we got a group together to do the calculator to figure out that we were at 2% real food, and so we could move upward from there. You know, it's the Real Food Challenge is a student-originated national movement to get universities to move towards real food, but the key is to get the administration to commit. The original commitment that we were looking for was 20% by 2020, which is now too close. And it's better. We're up to 5 or 6%. Thanks to the new leadership in dining. But to get to 25 by 2025, which is our new goal, we need buy-in from administration. So when we began the Real Food Challenge, and there are four categories, local, we can find local vendors, even though the big challenge there is that we consume so much that there aren't that many local farms that grow enough vegetables or whatever that we need. And it takes more work on the part of dining because they have to be flexible. They don't get the reliable Cisco supply of iceberg lettuce every week if you're going local. So that local is one thing, and then environmentally sound. Well, we've got, you know, more and more people are going organic, so we can find organic stuff. The categories that are maybe the hardest, I thought, were humane and fair. Humane because the vast majority of the meat produced in the U.S. is raised industrially. Fair, again, labor practices are not well documented, and there's, you know, to be certified that you're treating your workers well in agriculture is unusual. Increasing those categories, it struck me, would be the hardest. But today it feels like, you know, maybe in the area of humane, we're going to make big strides.
My name is Rahul Srivastav. I'm the executive director of IU Dining. One of my pillars of belief is sustainable food. Without that food, we will not be able to go anywhere. As a dining program, we'll not be able to move forward. We'll not be able to sustain what we have around in our community. And we have to support our local farmers and local product. So after I met with Carl and the IU Sustainability Group and talked about how we should be doing this, and they were like, okay, we're waiting for somebody like you. So they were pretty thrilled with that. So I was excited too. You know, like you need a purpose to come to your job. You know, you find that purpose and it doesn't become a job anymore. You're here because you love it. And, you know, like, so being a state university, we have to support our state resources. And the last part of it is, it's fresher, better food for you. Instead of getting it from California or getting it from down in Arizona or something like that. But it's so much fresher, so much better for us. So that was the reason.
Why do you think it's important to have fresh and better food on your campus? I mean, everybody's sort of used to cafeteria food just being kind of crappy food.
That's a very good question. So our students are coming to us at a very moldable age, very educational age. You know, like, food choices matter, and how you lead your life, how you do things, so it matters. It's something that we take upon ourselves to educate our students. Like, hey, I ate this fish taco here today, which was amazing, which I wouldn't have tried as a cafeteria food. If we can introduce these items to them and feed them better, it's one of my goals. We are setting patterns for the future. Make better decisions in life, make better decisions for sustainability, understand where the food is coming from. The amount of students that are around here, they're understanding where the food is coming from, who's supplying it. There's Dave Fisher talking to them about, this is the beef you're eating at that cheesesteak place, and there's a farmer right there, Harton Farms. Trish is right there talking about the vegetables that are being used and that stuff. So, like, that kind of transparency in food chain is very, very important. So
I'm sure the challenges are many, but if you could just talk about one of the things that you're finding really difficult in terms of trying to make this institutional shift. You know, you're used to getting from these large suppliers. How do you make that shift? Can Teresa Bertel's farm really supply the entire vegetables for the university?
That's a very good call. And can you do it for the entire university? But you have to start small. When you start small, the other farmers start getting affected. They see what's happening and they start supplying. But the challenge, let me talk to you about the challenge a little bit. The challenge is huge. we've been crafted by companies like Walmart, etc., that come in here and talk about like food and how they supply it to us and where they get it from. We've got no idea where that food is coming from, how it's getting to us. Walmart's entering the dairy business now. That's going to get a little bit scarier for all of us, because milk is one thing. People look at the price on that gallon, almost like the gas price. So the challenge is that the biggest barrier is changing a mindset of a human being that this is better for you. That's the biggest challenge that we have in our hands right now. Not only me, these farms, other food preparers and chefs that are back there making this food, and administrators who believe in real food. The biggest is the mindset. Is it really cheaper? It may not be cheaper on the price. It may be cheaper in many other ways. It may hold longer. It may not take you to the doctor so many times. You may save money on the medical side of it. You may save money on many other places. And the other part is you'll be supporting a community. And that's the stuff. So the challenge is huge. It's a mindset that we've been molded into. The second part is expensive. You've got to think through expensive. Salmon that we get from our purveyor that has got no transparency to it right now, it's about the same price as the Vercello salmon. But we have to do a little bit of work on it. You know, like you get the whole side versus fillets. And that's okay. If I do that work, I'm actually training somebody how to cut fillets out of a side. So I'm teaching a job skill. So we're making that change. We're going to be making that change. We're going to be adding vegetables into our meats, like the poke bowl. It's got quinoa, it's got rice, it's got radishes, etc. on it. And it's got a couple of pieces of salmon. Yes, it's there, but it's great. And it's not very expensive, as you see the price on it and the poke bowl. So that's a way to keep the cost down and keep it going.
Thank you so much for talking with me. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
So we've heard from some of the organizers of the Real Food Challenge and the director of IU Dining, who's completely on board. Next, we'll talk to a couple of the local farmers involved in making this dream a reality. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young. More after a quick break. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent providing customized financial services for individuals, businesses, and disabled adults, including tax planning, bill paying, and estate services. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, whose local branch is now located at 1155 College Mall Road. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, and team offer personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. We are back at the Big Red Eats Green event on the IU campus, highlighting the Real Food Challenge. Let's check in with a farmer helping to supply some of that real food.
Dave Fisher with Fisher Farms. IU and the whole Bloomington area, it's just been a super supportive of our attempt to sell locally sustainable beef over the last 14 years. Blooming Foods being one of our first customers, David Talent and other places as well, Nick's English Hut. Jeff Meese, all these folks have just been tremendous customers of ours. And IU has, over the last couple of years, grown and really has pushed to be buying local sustainable beef. We raise the beef on our farm. Our neighbors raise the pork. On the beef, the biggest difference on us is we raise them all naturally. So there's no growth hormones, no feed additives. The other thing is that we're very big on the environmental impact of our beef. We're actually pushed to capture carbon through the process of raising the beef, which is the exact opposite of what most people hear about when you talk about eating meat. We worked with the University of Kentucky on some analysis, and our belief, and they've backed it up with some numbers, is that we're capturing 5 pounds of carbon for every 1 pound of beef that we've sold over the last 7 years. It's a big part of the cover crops that we raise and how we put the manure back out on the fields. We never do any tillage. So those kind of things help us really grow the organic matter in our soil, which helps capture the carbon. Most of the time, most of their lives, they're out on pastures grazing. For the last 3 to 4 months, we do bring them into these very large barns, open-air barns. And during that time, we're still, though, feeding them a combination of ryegrass silage and corn silage that we've captured from our fields. So we grew our farm about 10 years ago when we decided we were going to serve a local market. One thing I wanted to make sure is that we were economical alternative, that we weren't so high priced that people couldn't afford it. So we knew right away that we had to do a larger quantity than what we were doing before. So we really ramped up our farm to do that. Now we see it long term, what we've been doing in the last probably 5 or 6 years is we rent more farms from other farmers, specifically farmers that have a lot of crop ground, but they also have some hills for pasture. Well, we rent their hills for the pasture and they can keep the crop ground. So that's one way we've expanded. The other way is just working with other farmers to raise calves. We're big on our genetics and make sure that the genetics are good quality. And then we will buy their calves. And most of the time right now, we're finishing those calves out ourselves. So we have them for the last 6 months of their lives.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much. Good talking with you.
Teresa Bertles, and I own Heartland Family Farm. I am a local farm vendor, and since Dave Talent took over the IU catering, he has begun to buy from local farmers. So I'm one of those local farmers. It demands a lot greater scale than what we've grown on in the past. But it's also a real blessing for a farmer because you have a dedicated place where you can actually move a lot of local product. This is our first year to sell to the IMU, so we're still trying to figure out exactly what to grow and our timing. Because in Indiana, of course, you know, all of the zucchinis and cucumbers and all of these things are in their peak before the students come back. So I'm thinking ahead of maybe timing some of those products to be ready a little later in the season rather than having that glut in June.
Do you think if you're working at the scale that you might not need to be at the farmer's market?
That is correct. I wouldn't necessarily need to come to the farmer's market, but I'm also from the school of thought that you shouldn't put all of your eggs in one basket. So I have the restaurant sales, I have the CSA, both the summer CSA and the winter CSA, and then I have the farmer's market. And that's also our social time and the time to interact with other farmers as well as our customers. So I would really hate to give up that social interaction and putting that face to your food.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me, Teresa.
Thank you.
It's a big shift, an institutional shift, with implications across our community. We'll hear more about it next week, so be sure to tune in. Jackie B. Howard is back with us today. Jackie works here at the station, and she's cooked professionally for many years. This week, she's making a dish inspired by a traditional cabbage roll, but instead of rolling the filling in cabbage leaves, she's sautéing it all together, an unrolled cabbage roll, if you will.
One head of organic cabbage, and I'm going to give it like a big chunky dice. Since we're not taking the leaves off and rolling them, I still want that sort of like big leafy feel to it, so I'm going to leave them in big chunks in my saute. I've quartered the cabbage and then halved each of those quarters and cutting them into 1-inch chunks. Got my pan hot. It's ready to go, and I'm putting in about 2 tablespoons of olive oil. Mom would use butter for this. My mom would use butter for any time we're having cabbage. You can do that too, but I'm going to use olive oil. What's great about cabbage is it's really economical. A little goes a long way, and a whole head of cabbage is going to make a meal for 4 people easily. While this is going, I've got some almonds toasting in the oven for the romesco sauce. That romesco, if you're not familiar, is it's a roasted red pepper sauce with almonds. And for me, the 2 key ingredients to make a fantastic romesco sauce is lots of smoked paprika and a good sherry vinegar. Sherry vinegar can be hard to find sometimes. If you really have to sub it, you can do a sherry cooking wine and red wine vinegar, but I highly recommend seeking out that sherry vinegar and then just having it at home so you can do this whenever the mood strikes. So I'm putting in a pound of ground turkey in with that on that olive oil. I'm doing some oil because the turkey is lean, and I want to make sure that it pulls out. It adds a little bit of fat to that turkey to pull out some flavor and get a nice base for adding when I want to add the cabbage to it as well. Doing about a teaspoon of salt and about a teaspoon of black pepper just right on my turkey to season it. I'm not going to do much in seasoning it because I'm going to make the Romesco sauce, and I want that to be the main seasoning component. So for the turkey and cabbage itself, it's really just going to be salt and pepper. All right, while that's cooking, I'm going to start on the Romesco sauce. So I have a jar of roasted red peppers. They're in olive oil. It's a 12-ounce jar. I'm going to use all 12 ounces of this. I'm going to drain the liquid from it and just use the peppers themselves. These peppers have a few garlic cloves in them. I'm going to leave those, as well as I've retained about 2 tablespoons of the olive oil from the jar. Then I'm adding 2 fresh garlic cloves. So I've blended that up. I love how beautiful roasted red peppers pureed together. I mean, it just is so bright and exciting. Oh, I love it so much. And then I'm gonna take some flat leaf parsley. You wanna use fresh if you can. If you can't, I wouldn't use a dried parsley in this. I would just do like a dried oregano. There are ways to be traditional about it, and then there are ways that utilize what you have. And that's the most efficient. If you only are ever doing a recipe because you have all of the ingredients, and that's the only time you're gonna cook, then you're so rarely gonna cook, and it becomes such a stressful thing. But if you give yourself the freedom to play around and use what's available, then you'll find yourself cooking often because you can see far more possibility with what you have. So while I was getting the sauce prepped, my ground turkey is about cooked through, so I'm gonna go ahead and throw the cabbage in here as well while I finish the sauce. Now I'm doing it in a big Dutch oven, so I'm gonna get about half this cabbage put in at one time, and then we'll add the other half. I actually like that texture difference. Some will have a little bit more bite to it than others, and I prefer that. I'm adding another half a teaspoon of salt and pepper for my cabbage. I'm gonna let that sit and saute a little bit while I finish the sauce. I've got the roasted red peppers, the garlic, the herbs. I'm gonna start with about 1/4 cup of the almonds. It's gonna be really loud. I'm gonna add another handful of nuts, a tablespoon of smoked paprika, and I'm gonna go ahead and put in a couple of teaspoons of sherry vinegar. Probably gonna end up at about 1/4 cup in terms of the flavor that I like from it. It's gonna be loud again. The cabbage and turkey is starting to cook down a little bit. I'm gonna go ahead and add the other half of my head of cabbage to this. Traditionally, a cabbage roll is just a sort of basic tomato sauce, so we're playing around with that with the Romesco. Roasted red pepper and sherry vinegar are gonna be really good with the cabbage. So it's a fun play. And I think also that the almonds in the sauce are gonna add a really nice texture to it as well. So I'm tasting. You can see that the sauce is much thicker after our second round, but still not pasty. So good. You want to taste it?
Yes.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah?
I think it needs salt. Yeah, but maybe not too much. But.
Okay, all right. And we'll see how this goes once it melts with my turkey and cabbage. So I haven't put in more sherry. I also think that the smoked paprika is at a really nice level right now, and we'll see how that might need to be adjusted after it gets cooked in with the cabbage. So I'm putting this right into my pot with my cabbage and turkey, the ground turkey. With most good things, the longer they sit, the better they taste. Those flavors meld together. But I'm going to give this a taste now and see if there's any sort of initial adjustments I want to make to the flavor. So I think that it needs some more sherry vinegar and a little bit more salt. If I want to add, I might add more oregano as well. Now this is very much a down-home sort of meal. It's not the prettiest thing you've ever eaten. You could pretty it up. Easily this could be deconstructed if you wanted to be fancy about it. Or, you know, if you wanted to be really fancy, roll it.
It was time to taste the unrolled cabbage rolls with the romesco sauce added to the pan.
Yeah, that additional sherry vinegar really brought out the other flavors.
The green vegetable in particular needs some sort of, it's so hearty and deep and earthy in flavor that it needs that brightness, it needs that acidity to brighten that up. In the middle of the bite, it really falls flat and it's not bland, but it doesn't taste like, you don't feel any sort of like pop out of it.
It doesn't excite.
It doesn't, that's great, yes, it doesn't excite. And if it's not that excite, then it needs acid. That's a great way to put that, yes.
How would I know that it wasn't salt that it needed?
When you're tasting something, there are three stages to it. The first one, can I taste this? When I put it in my mouth, can I taste it? Do I have some sort of like initial flavor to it? If it doesn't, it needs salt. You want it to be flavorful, exciting, and then deep and warm. Those are the three steps of what a good bite should taste like, what a good dish should taste like. So just put a little bit of thought behind it. I promise you will find those things too. You just have to identify it for yourself.
And the paprika and the herbs are offering that warmth.
Correct. As this sits, the nuttiness of the almonds is going to contribute to that as well. The roasted red peppers are adding to the acid. The roastiness of them adds to the depth. So it's a fun, tasting is really fun.
Yes, tasting is fun, especially when you get to taste what Jackie B. Howard is making. That romesco sauce hits all the notes in all three stages of the bite. She makes it easy for you to try it too. Find this recipe at eartheats.org. That's it for our show. Thanks for listening, and thanks to everyone on the Earth Eats crew, including Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Renee Reed, Daniel Orr, everyone at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Stephen Lalovich, Carl Ibsen, Rahul Shrivastav, Teresa Bertels, and Jackie B. Howard. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. Production support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee shop committed to sustainable practices and organic, ethically sourced coffee from small-scale farmers, featuring handmade quiche, scones, and baked goods. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com.